Hey everyone, whenever you see someone cool, do you ever think, I bet they have parents? Well, boy, are you in for a surprise. Today's book is Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic, and as a father reading this book to my 8-year-old boy, I forgot how dark it gets, so he currently thinks that Cedric Diggory is now studying abroad.
And I'm David Vance. As a big fan of Goblets and Fire, I was so glad they did a collab. Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire is a 4,000-page Russian novel about cannibalism. It won the Newbery Medal.
And this is The Book Pile.
So, quick reminder to please rate and review The Book Pile. We super appreciate it.
Podhost1 says, I have 5 podcasts I listen to that come out on Monday, and I always listen to The Book Pile first.
Oh, thank you.
Again, you and I tend to take compliments in the worst way possible, because even though he says it's the first one I listen to on Monday, I keep thinking, but like, which is your best day of the week for podcasts?
I think you may have a problem. Can someone just leave a review where they say, Kellen, I love you?
I would be like, yeah, but I mean, why did they have to put a comma in there? That seems
hesitant.
So please rate and review. And also note that at least on Apple Podcasts, Apple can take up to 48 hours to post your review. So don't worry if you click to post it and then you don't see it on there, it'll show up. Also, as always, there are spoilers ahead. I want to say that now because usually Dave will spoil something and then he'll say, oh, that was a spoiler.
All right, without further ado, here are our favorite 4 lessons from Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. All right, lesson 1, mix genres. So this is a short one. We talk a lot about how great creators often combine different fields. So people like Einstein, Da Vinci, Jennifer Doudna, Lin-Manuel Miranda. And I think that's true with genres as well. So this book is fantasy, but it borrows from a bunch of genres. So the beginning is like a murder mystery where the Riddles die, and it's this little whodunit where Frank Bryce is falsely accused. And then they're at the Quidditch World Cup, and it's a sports story. And before that, they're with the Dursleys, which is basically like a Roald Dahl story. And then the Triwizard Tournament is almost like a gladiator story. And then Voldemort comes back, and it's like a Nazi story. So I once went to a used bookshop where they had 6 different biographies of Hitler and 2 of Goebbels. And at that point, it felt like it was more than just academic. Anyway, all this to say, I think this goes beyond literature. Like, whatever your field is, can you bring in something else that interests you and that makes for an interesting combination?
So the Lin-Manuel Miranda, you're referring to his genre mix of R&B and a book?
For him, I'm talking about the mixed skill set of, you know, writing, composition, production, acting, rapping, singing, question mark?
I was just mixing genres of comedy and mediocre podcasting. Did you ever read the Roald Dahl book on about poaching?
No, unless it's about poaching people and it's the landlady, in which case, yes.
What is the landlady?
The landlady is the short story he writes where there's an old woman who does taxidermy on people she murders in her house.
Whoa. So was,
you know, kid stuff.
I was going to say, was that Roald Dahl's, was that his casual vacancy? Like, speaking of J.K. Rowling.
I don't know, man. All his stuff is pretty dark. You don't read a Roald Dahl book and think, I bet he was happy growing up.
All right. Lesson 2, make me care. That's all. And this is like, I love books. I love movies. People call me a snob about movies, but really it just comes down to, if you can make me care, I'll care. In reference to Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, how do you make someone care? I have this question for you, Dave. How do you make someone care? I don't think that you can always put your finger on it, but if you're writing a story, there are things that you can insert. You can give them stakes, but you also need to make them someone who you empathize for or you sympathize with, at least. So in Harry Potter, we
one way to make them not likable is to have them ask someone a question and then just not wait for an answer.
Well, I was what I meant was, I'm going to ask you the question so you can think about it while I'm giving you my theories.
Got it.
So in The Goblet of Fire, by the way, I hate the movie Goblet of Fire. That's something that's going to come up more than once in this episode.
Those goblets were not nearly fiery enough.
For these reasons, that they took out so many of the reasons that made us care. Every sequel of any movie needs to be written as if it could be a standalone. That's how I feel. And in this movie, at no point do they ever reference Harry being an orphan. And then all of a sudden we just at the very end we see his parents appear in the Praetorian Incantatum, that the spell where shadowy figures each of Voldemort's kills is coming out of the spell and sort of cheering Harry on. That's the first time that we even like see his parents there. So in the book, it's very touching because you're reminded of this. In the book, Harry feels inadequate because he's so much younger than the other champions. The book essentially, it begins at the Dursleys and he has to leave. And that's always sort of a jumping off point of relief of, ah, this kid is so mistreated. And then in the end, it's the actions that he takes, like letting Cedric take the cup with him, which apparently was actually a bad idea. But it makes you it makes you care about Harry and the person that he is.
Do you judge that action by the intention or the result? Like if someone tries to donate to charity, but it turns out that charity is ISIS, did they do a good or bad thing? Like if Harry came to me and he's like, Cedric's dead because of me, and I were being honest with my friend, I'd be like, well, yeah. Yeah, he is, huh? Yeah, I guess if you put it that way.
Yeah, that was when Cedric's parents came, that was like the ultimate good news, bad news situation.
Well, at the end, they're like, well, at least he just won, so at least he died happy. And there's this little part of me that always wants Harry in that scene to be like, oh, no, he was just more confused in the moment. We just like teleported to this graveyard. Yeah, more confused is how I'd describe him.
He died doing what he loved, stumbling around a graveyard full of Death Eaters. J.K. Rowling skipped over there was a great opportunity for the most awkward moment of all time when the person with the giant bag of money is like looking at the Diggories, but like giving it to Harry. Anything to add to that? You've probably written more scripts than I have. What do you do to make people care about your main characters?
Well, Shonda Rhimes says that the first 10 pages of your script were really just getting to know your protagonist. So I think anything that gives us like a strong taste of their personality or their voice, that kind of thing. I think we also root for people who are underdogs in some way. Like you said, you know, Harry comes from this background where he's horribly mistreated and he doesn't have parents and he's come into this wizarding world basically knowing nothing about how it works. And then these terrible things are always happening to him where he's always being thrust into danger. And then I think we also like people who are very competent. So David Chase, the creator of The Sopranos, said this where he's like, your protagonist can be a terrible person and he can be evil and selfish, but as long as he or she is good at their job and they're the smartest person in the room, the audience is with them. And Phoebe Waller-Bridge says that about Fleabag as well. She's like, yeah, Fleabag isn't always the best person, but she's always funny, so we're always with her. And so for me, there's something about those like competent underdog characters who combine those last two traits. Like Harry's a competent underdog, Katniss is a competent underdog, Ender and Ender's Game. Like you look across all these different genres and stories, and I think you see the competent underdog resurfacing over and over again because there's something about that combination that really speaks to us.
Mm. And then there's Sirius, who is just a dog. If I could add to what you're saying.
A worthy contribution. The character, okay, for those reasons, the character who I've never understood the adulation he gets is Boba Fett. Boba Fett has a cool looking suit, and then he gets whooped in every fight we ever see him in, like very easily.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is that we do feel bad for him when people like you call him Bubba Fett instead of Boba Fett.
I'll call him Boba Fett when he learns how to fight.
So, if you can make me care, I'll care. I don't know how else to put it, but it is so frustrating to go to Godzilla versus Kong, like 98% expecting to get, you know, just mindless, you know, monsters. But there is that hope that they could just throw in some characters that I also cared about.
I went to Kong versus Godzilla only to every 10 minutes yell, "Kiss!"
I feel like there's a real missed opportunity there for at some point Kong to be on a skyscraper and then Godzilla is running toward him, like smashing things with a mallet. I appreciate, you know, special effects, but ultimately it just comes down to, do I care about this character or not? So you look at something like King Kong that had, you know, a $200 million budget, Avatar had a $300 million budget. But the point is, I feel more, I care more about the people in a movie like Safety Not Guaranteed that had a budget of $6 million, or Love and Monsters, which had a budget of 30, which is still a very, very small budget for like a monster movie. By the way, Love and Monsters, I don't know if you, have you seen it?
No.
It's surprisingly good, especially because if you're going to judge a book by its cover, the movie poster for Love and Monsters, it looks like it belongs on the CW.
What two things is it about?
From what you said earlier, that's what you really wanted Godzilla versus Kong to be called.
Yeah. Okay, lesson three. So I'm actually not going to say the lesson yet because I'm worried it will sound trite. First, I'm going to tell a story. So a couple years ago, I wanted to be a better writer, so I reread Harry Potter to analyze why I liked it so much, which I'm pretty sure was just an excuse to read it. Anyway, I noticed in every scene that got me emotional, there was this common pattern, and I'm going to tell you some of those scenes. So in book four, he's in the hospital wing on this horrible night when Voldemort comes back, and Molly Weasley gives him a hug, and it says, "He had no memory of ever being hugged like this, as though by a mother." And a lot of listeners with mothers are like, same. Then book five.
Listeners.
So then in book five, there's the scene where Voldemort's possessing Harry and it's agony. And Harry thinks, "End it, Dumbledore. Death is nothing compared to this. And I'll see Sirius again." And in that moment of emotion, that's when Voldemort is like driven from his body. And then finally, book seven, Harry's walking to his death and his parents and Sirius and Lupin appear to him. And he just wants to know if it hurts to die. And I noticed this common pattern, which is actually my lesson here, which is some of our...
Don't be afraid to die. Oh.
Some of our best storytelling moments are about love in the face of adversity. So there's something about that combo of the happiness and the sadness that hits really well for us and just gives us this poignancy. And now I see it in my favorite stories. So Hamilton, their son dies, and that's when Eliza forgives Alexander, and it's the moment where everyone cries. Inside Out, at the end, Riley forms a core memory that's happy and sad while her parents are hugging her, and again, everyone cries. Little Women, Beth asks Joe to keep writing stories even when she's not here, and no one cries because Beth had it coming. No one's that nice. Beth's hiding something. But I think you get some like really powerful moments with those stories about love in the face of adversity.
I love that movie too, Inside Out, because essentially to pitch it, I imagine that it was Pete Docter was like, "All right, the whole movie is about this girl who decides she's going to run away from home and then she doesn't. What do you think?" And they're like, "That sucks." And they're like, "Okay." And that's when they came back later about, "What if we were inside her brain the whole time?"
And she's like, "Sad sometimes." Interested now?
All right. Lesson four, only keep characters who have a purpose. Have you heard the story of the Weasley cousin, Mafalda?
No, I haven't.
So halfway through what J.K. Rowling thought was going to be the Goblet of Fire, she felt like she was digging herself into this giant plot hole. And it was connected to this cousin of the Weasleys. And she ended up taking her out completely. And wow. But she wanted to get the story right. So J.K. Rowling says of this character, Mafalda served the same function that Rita Skeeter now serves. Rita was always going to be in the book, but I built her up because I needed a kind of conduit for information outside the school. And originally, Mafalda fulfilled this purpose. So she has these characters with purposes in mind. It isn't just to bring on this new quirky character just for, you know, another sequel book, but it was because the kids, they needed a medium with this, this outside information would come from. And then Rowling continues, she says, Mafalda made it quite a long way into Goblet of Fire before I cut her. I really liked her as a character, but she just wasn't doing the job she was supposed to do, so she had to go. So apparently this girl was, she was really mischievous. And so she had this history of eavesdropping on people. And so she had done that a bunch before coming to Hogwarts that year. And then she was going to be sort of the source of gossip. But J.K. Rowling was saying that became very limiting now that she was sort of just closeted inside the school. It sounds like it didn't fulfill a purpose as efficiently as J.K. Rowling wanted. So she essentially just wove this character into the character of Rita Skeeter. It makes me wish that more authors were aware of, and I think that that's why we can see that these books are so tightly written. Like, I feel like if you picked up any of the Harry Potter books and you just randomly tore out 8 pages, you would have questions at the end, right? That's how much... Like the density of the information that she puts in, the purpose of every character, paragraph, sentence has. Whereas if you did the same thing with like a Stephen King novel or Ayn Rand, like you'd finish it wishing that you'd torn out more, you know?
I feel like that's true unless I tore out the 8 pages in every book where she re-explains what magic is.
And I said before, I'm a fan of some Stephen King stuff. It's mostly his short stories. His, remember, his rule is, what is it? A second draft equals a first draft minus 10%.
Minus 10%.
I think his stuff would be even better if it was minus 35%. I want him to try that just once and see how much that hurts the story.
I'm in this weird place with Stephen King where I've read On Writing, but I've read none of his novels. So when I take all of his advice and apply it, there's this part of me that's like, man, I hope this turned out well for you.
So this is, you know how I hate Ron. And this movie doesn't help.
I gotta say, I remember nothing about the movie.
Do you remember liking the movie?
Oh, no. I remember liking very few of the movies.
Okay, yeah. Same here. So I know that you go to sleep clutching a copy of Harry Potter based on the day of the week. So maybe you can tell me, could you tell me what Ron's purpose is in the book? Because in the movie, he contributes zero. And I'm not just saying that because I hate him as a character and as a person.
Ron in the books is a grounded everyman character who is the best friend and confidant of the protagonist. He deals with like different struggles that Harry Potter doesn't struggle with. Like Ron is way more insecure. A lot of Ron's struggles actually are kind of more human. And I feel like in many ways he's a more fleshed out human character than Harry.
But what is his purpose in the Goblet of Fire?
Oh, in the Goblet of Fire, I mean, he's one of the main sources of conflict when he and Harry have that big falling out because she makes Harry feel so alone, like everyone has turned on him, even his best friend. And then later he's like supportive and encouraging to Harry as he's preparing for tasks, that kind of thing.
I mean, he's not supportive, but he is encouraging because his Ron's support is always... Come on, Harry, just cheat.
Yeah, a couple other side characters that at first seem maybe a little bit superfluous, but then serve a structural role in the story. Ludo Bagman doesn't seem like he's doing a lot, but then it turns out he's had this ongoing like gambling story with Fred and George, and he acts as sort of a red herring where she plants enough clues that you could plausibly think he's the bad guy who's helping bring Voldemort back. Winky for so much of it just seems annoying. And then at the end, she is this treasure trove of information that solves mysteries. Honestly, the only Harry Potter characters that I would cut are every centaur. I think I hated every scene with the centaurs in it. They were never interesting. They were never funny. They were never compelling. They just show up and act superior and frustrating. And you're like, I'm glad wizards have mistreated you.
I will say, as good as J.K. Rowling is at giving dozens and dozens of characters distinct personality traits, she does just make all of the centaurs serious and condescending. Oh, according to you, because I haven't read it, but a superfluous character in Les Miserables would probably be Napoleon Bonaparte.
Yes.
So, in conclusion of this point, Napoleon is the Ron Weasley of Les Miserables. He's unlikable, a jerk, and you just kind of don't need him in the end.
Are you still just talking movie, or are you talking book, too?
Oh, both. I can't stand. I love the Weasleys.
So much Ron slander.
I love the Weasleys, but I can't stand Ron. Like, I lose a little respect for Harry that he's friends with him. That's what I'm saying. There's nothing... Ron is a bad friend.
All right, random facts. So I've read that when Paul McCartney showed Sgt. Pepper to Bob Dylan, Dylan was like, oh, I get it. You don't want to be cute anymore. And that's kind of how I feel about book four, where, you know, it's really the turning point of the series. You know, up to this point, it's kind of been this Scooby-Doo story with kids solving mysteries. And then JK's like, I'm going to kill a teenager right in front of you. And then just the whole timbre of the series changes.
So the actor Michael Gambon got paid $15 million collectively to play Dumbledore, and he still didn't read the books. And this,
what would he have gotten paid if he did a good job?
Yeah, it upsets me so much. Like, I don't understand anyone who enjoys this movie, how you can defend this movie with Dumbledore's reaction to finding Harry Potter's name in the Goblet of Fire. Do you remember that moment?
In the book, he's super calm, and then the movie, he has a conniption where he's like, did you put your name in that goblet?
Yeah, he screams at him. He like gives Harry this cold stare as Harry walks out of the Great Hall. And then during the meeting with the champions, this is no exaggeration, he straight up slams Harry into a pile of old trophies. He assaults him. It's so out of character.
Well, you know
what
they say in acting class, make interesting choices.
It's just so out of character. It's like watching Mr. Rogers punch a wall. It just seems so lazy to me, right? To get that much money and to still be like, I mean, I already have this script. I don't want to have to read two things.
That's in his contract. Won't read two things. So Stephen King makes fun of JK for using a million adverbs. I think we should make fun of her for using a million ellipses. Have you noticed this in the book? I turned to a random spot and counted the ellipses on those two pages. 26. Oh, man. Like, is everything in the book an innuendo?
So here's a bit of a plot hole for me in the book as well. Why don't the Weasleys just use that tent magic on their own house?
So Cedric asks Harry to take his body back to his parents, and Harry risks his life to bring him back to Hogwarts, and it's very sweet. But then he leaves before the parents get there, so he has no idea if that body made it to those parents. Oh, no. Cedric asked him for one thing. Like, if someone asks you to dog sit, you don't get to peace out for the last hour of it.
Cedric's also like, take my body back, Harry, and delete my browser history. So the producer David Heyman and screenwriter Stephen Cloves both said that they imagined it might have to be two movies. And it's crazy to me that they didn't commit to that. But what's crazier to me is that Cloves ultimately said, quote, we can never figure out a way to break it in two, end quote. Really? Like, here's a solution. Just do what you did with the last book and stop halfway through the story. Like, there's no end to the Deathly Hallows part one. It's just over until the next one. Like, they could have just stopped it. They could have put in more of the book and just called the first one Harry Potter and 1/3 of the Triwizard Tournament.
So one of the morals of this book is that journalists can ruin your life by misquoting you. So I love that JK is like, nope, I'm going to ruin my life by being quoted verbatim. And I will constantly be doubling down.
Yeah, that would be the modern version of this would be Rita Skeeter is just a character that encourages Harry to be prolific on Twitter. He'll dig his own grave.
I also love that the moral of these books is be kind to marginalized groups unless they actually exist.
Speaking of which, I have a real problem in the book and especially the movie with the way that Harry and Ron treat their dates at the Yule Ball.
Oh, yeah.
Like, these are the only two Indian characters. And they ignore them completely. It is, even on Harry's end, it's really obnoxious. He doesn't even make eye contact.
Bear in mind about Harry and Ron that Hermione asked them to help her end slavery, and they're both like, nah.
Yeah, no.
So
it's also like if you watch the movie Goblet of Fire without having read the book, it's a jarring, unexplained mess, which I did. I saw the first four movies before I touched any of the books, and I didn't know what was happening during so many of the moments. In the book, there's these obstacles in the maze, right? There's a Sphinx, there's the blast-ended Scroots, which is just such a fun part of the book that wasn't included. But then the only thing that happens in the maze in the movie is that Dumbledore pulls all the champions in and he's like, beware, this maze will change who you are. And then that doesn't really happen.
It'll make you someone who goes to mazes for fun.
It only really changes Crumb, but it doesn't even change Crumb. You just find that he's under the Imperius curse. So that was...
It'll make you slightly and temporarily lost. It'll make you think that maybe your date will make out with you in there, but it never happens.
Oh, that's some specific corn maze information, Dave. You want to elaborate?
No, I'm talking about broad universal experiences.
Have you gone to a haunted maze thinking you'd get some action? Was that your move? Maybe when I'm clinging to this girl all scared... So another thing that I didn't understand when I watched the movie was why are these schools that come from other countries, why are they same sex? It's like they're not in the book, but for some dumb reason in the movie, everyone from the French magic school is a girl, but everyone from the Bulgarian school is a boy. They are, which is crazy to me when I was watching, because I remember watching it thinking like, oh, so if you're like a French boy wizard, you just have to like learn everything on YouTube. Like there's just, sorry. It's like when you're a kid and you think that all dogs are boys and all cats are girls. I don't know why they did that.
All right, last one. There's a quote I like from the book. If you want to know what a man's like, take a good look at how he treats his inferiors, not his equals. Mm. And then a follow-up. Also, does he call other people inferiors?
The CGI is pretty disappointing throughout this entire thing, but they do sort of, they open up this international Quidditch match as like the biggest event you've ever seen in any Harry Potter movie. And literally after Cornelius Fudge says, let's start this thing, it cuts right to everyone celebrating in the tent afterward. There is zero Quidditch in it. It would be like if all the X-Wing fighters left to go destroy the Death Star, and then the next scene is that award ceremony.
They're just picking Death Star shrapnel off their suits.
We sure did a good job. And then finally, this one is just sort of fun. Don't watch the movie, but do rent it and go to the 43-minute, 38-second mark where Sirius is talking in the fireplace. And at one part, at one moment, he calls Voldemort Voldabar.
All right, to recap, our favorite lessons from Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Number one, mix genres. Number two, make me care. Number three, some of our best storytelling moments are about love in the face of adversity. Number four, only keep characters who have a purpose.
And number five, the movie is just okay.